Comet 3I Atlas brightens and shifts into the blue. China releases its images of 3I Atlas. Space debris delays a Chinese return flight from the space station. And Jared Isaacman gets another shot at being NASA's administrator. And in Space Bites Plus, how could we find von Neumann probes in the solar system right now? All this and more in this week's Space Bites. So the news about 3I Atlas has died down a bit this week, and that's just because the comet is on its way past the far side of the sun from our perspective. But, you know, fortunately, there's a lot of spacecraft that are able to observe the environment around the sun. They use a coronagraph to block the sun, and then they're able to see the atmosphere of the sun and comets that happen to be passing in that region, and 3I Atlas is one of those. So one interesting piece of news is that the comet appears to be brightening and a little more quickly than traditionally you get with Oort cloud objects, and that's very interesting. And that's kind of tied into another aspect of this, which is that the spectra that astronomers are taking of the comet is a little bit more blue than you would normally expect with a comet. And like, it's really important to say the comet has not turned blue, or the comet has not turned red. It's that the spectrum of light that is coming from it is a little bit more shifted to the blue. And so what you have from comets, you know, they are these dirty snowballs that are filled with rock and metal and ice and other volatile elements. And as they heat up from the sun, the material sublimates off of the surface of it. And depending on the composition of that material, you're going to get the coma, the area surrounding the comet, to shift either towards the blue or towards the red. If it's more towards the red, then that indicates that there's a lot of dust that's mixed in with the coma. So think about how when there's forest fires, when there's smoke in the air, then the sky turns more of a red color because the fine particles in the air block the shorter wavelengths. And so you see less of the blue and you see more of the red that's coming from the sun. But if it's more gas, then it's going to be more shifted towards the blue. And so think about how when you look at the sky, skies are blue. We've got the light that's coming from the sun. It is scattering in the atmosphere, and you're seeing this blue when you look up into the sky. And so this is a very useful tool for astronomers to be able to calculate the composition of the coma around the comet. Is it more gas-centric or is it more dust-centric? And it really does appear that 3I Atlas is a little bit more towards the blue. Its current magnitude is 9, which is sort of the kind of object that you could see with a backyard telescope, maybe a very strong pair of binoculars. And so over the next couple of weeks, we're going to see a lot of amateur astronomers start taking images of 3I Atlas. And of course, we're looking forward to it getting closer and closer until it reaches its closest point to the Earth in mid-December. And so really for the next month or so, we're going to have a new view to 3I Atlas, and then it's going to start to fade away again as it makes its way out towards Jupiter. So this next month is going to be great, and I think we're going to get new images from Hubble, from Webb, from a lot of the big ground-based observatories at a time when it's producing its largest tail, and we'll be able to study it the best. And we've got a roundup of all the latest news from 3I Atlas from Mark Thompson on Universe Today. But let's rewind a little bit and remember when 3I Atlas made its closest approach to Mars. And there's a fleet of spacecraft at Mars that we're going to attempt to take pictures of the comet. So we got successful images from the European Space Agency's ExoMars orbiter. We got some images from the ground from the Perseverance rover, but we didn't get any images from ESA's Mars Express spacecraft. And we're still waiting on the images from NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. But there was another nation at Mars, and that is, of course, China's Tianwen-1 orbiter. Now, the lander and the rover have long since died, but the orbiter is still in operation many years after its arrival at Mars. And so they did the same thing. Let's try and see if we can take images of 3I Atlas as it makes its closest approach to Mars. So it captured its images at 28.96 million kilometers away. So it's still not very close. And of course, Tianwen Orbiter is designed to look at very bright features on the surface of Mars, not faint objects in the sky. It can't do very long exposures. Features on the surface of Mars are between 10,000 and 100,000 times brighter than trying to see a comet go through the night sky. But they were able to resolve it. They were able to see the tail. And so here's some cool new images of the comet. Not great, but again, wrong machine for the job, still pretty far away. But more eyes. And people are always asking, like, when are we going to see China's images of it? Well, here you go. So this week we heard a surprising piece of news that NASA might have a new administrator again. And the candidate is Jared Isaacman, which is the person that Trump had originally nominated as the NASA administrator earlier this year. Now, of course, he had his fallout with Elon Musk, and I think that led to some bad blood to not only Musk, but maybe people that Musk had recommended. And so Jared Isaacman's name was removed from the nomination. And instead, Sean Duffy, who's already the Secretary of Transportation for the US government, took over the role of administrating NASA. But that's a lot of hats for one person to have. And of course, we're seeing this happen during the shutdown of the US government. And so it's been kind of tricky. NASA's been hit pretty hard by this so far. And then last week, we started to hear rumors that Trump was considering Jared Isaacman again. And we've seen some growing fights between the Sean Duffy camp and the Jared Isaacman camp. But now it appears that Trump has made his decision. And so we saw some supportive words from Sean Duffy. And we saw kind of an unofficial acceptance by Jared Isaacman that he would take on that role. Now, it's still waiting for it to go to another Senate confirmation hearing. And so if that passes, then Jared Isaacman will take on the mantle of being the NASA administrator. But, you know, nothing is certain yet. And so we'll sort of wait and see what happens. Now on to the Chinese Space Agency, which currently has two of its crew on board. It goes through these replacement operations, the same thing that happens with the International Space Station. And so the crew of Shenzhou 20, when they were getting ready to enter their return capsule, they realized that there was potentially damage from space debris. And so in order to be cautious, China decided, let's not bring the astronauts back home immediately. Let's study this problem a little bit more. And so this is kind of reminiscent what happened with the Soyuz spacecraft a couple of years ago with potential damage to it, reminiscent to what happened with the Starliner, which sort of marooned the astronauts on board the station for several months. So who knows how long they're going to have to remain while they go through this problem. But, you know, China has said they want to make sure that there's the safest return home possible. So we'll see what happens with that. But good news, they had a new oven delivered to the Chinese space station, and they were able to have barbecued chicken wings on board the station for the first time. So they have a new kind of microwave oven that can also perform science experiments. They were able to cook chicken wings and peppered steak on board the station. Like, I wonder what that must have been like smelling that. Now, it's a pretty tricky problem because you've got all these juices that are coming out of the chicken while you're cooking it on board the station in zero gravity, and the gases that are coming out of it as you're cooking the chicken. So, you know, trying to provide more creature comforts for your astronauts on board the station is very important, but that there's like additional cleanup, additional hassle that comes along with making food that isn't just sucking food out of a tube. So we'll wait and see again how this worked out and whether they want to continue on a regular basis having barbecue on the station. Meteorites are time capsules of the solar system. And it's only through studying meteorites that have fallen to Earth that planetary scientists have been able to calculate the age of the solar system. These meteorites are all about 4.54 billion years old. No matter where you find them on Earth, they all seem to have been formed at this same time. And so we assume that the sun and all of the planets and all the meteorites, they all formed around the same time. But there's a type of meteorite that is very important, very interesting, and very fragile. They shatter when they hit the Earth's atmosphere, and only five have ever been found. They're called carbonaceous avuna-type chondrites, and that is from a specific family of asteroids. And what makes these very interesting is that they contain about 3-5% carbon molecules, and they're about 20% water by weight. And so one of the questions that scientists have always had is, you know, how was water delivered to the early Earth? These kinds of meteorites, which don't survive interacting with the Earth very well, could have been the kind of asteroid that might have delivered water to the early Earth. But there's another place where these CI chondrites are raining down, and that's on the moon. And so China's Chang'e 6 sample return mission was able to collect samples of regolith from the moon, and they found examples of these CI chondrites mixed in with the regolith from being pounded for hundreds of millions of years. And when they brought the samples back home to Earth and identified the olivine mineral, they were able to calculate that these probably impacted the moon about 3.92 billion years ago, which was during the late heavy bombardment. And so when you put this all together, you get this situation where this water-rich asteroids with a lot of organic material are hammering into the moon and the Earth shortly after the formation of the solar system, in this time when a lot of these material is brought back to the Earth. And maybe this is the source. Maybe this is a significant contributor to Earth's water. If you want more information about that, we've got a story from Matt Williams. Now, we know that red dwarf stars are really dangerous for their planets when they're young. They're fully convective. They can release super flares that will strip away the atmospheres of planets that are orbiting around them. And in fact, now James Webb is on the job of trying to scan these red dwarf exoplanets, trying to find any that have atmospheres within the habitable zone. And so far, none have been found. And so is it possible that there are just like no terrestrial planets with atmospheres around red dwarf stars? Maybe. But maybe even if the red dwarf stars strip away their atmospheres early on in their formation, maybe they can still reform those atmospheres later on. So a new paper simulated what would happen to a planet as asteroid impacts are hammering it long after the red dwarf has settled down. It's no longer producing these killer solar flares. And they found that if you got a 10 kilometer asteroid slamming into the planet about once every 100 million years, which is kind of what we've experienced on Earth, so then you would have enough volatile elements going back into the atmosphere to kind of maintain an ongoing atmosphere. And really, the game with these planets around red dwarf stars, it's not about that first billion years, it's about the 100 trillion years that comes afterwards when you've got a long time in the glow of this star. And so if you get enough asteroid impacts crashing into these planets, that will produce your atmosphere and allow them to then produce life later on after their formation. We've got a story about this by Matt Williams. Every week we do a vote on the channel where you tell us what you thought was the best space news story of the week. And so the winner last week was that Comet 3A Atlas was seen just after its perihelion, a time when it's actually really hard to see a comet on the other side of the sun. So thank you everybody who voted last week. We're going to put the vote to this week's stories into the post tab here on our channel. So if you want to do that, make sure you subscribe to the channel, click on the notifications bell, then just go into the post tab, find a bunch of our past polls, click a bunch to give them your vote, and then that will train the algorithm to show them to you on a regular basis. So this is kind of a sad story, and that is that the Japanese Hakuto R1 mission that launched off the Earth in 2022 and was supposed to land in early 2023 failed. And we now have a pretty good idea of what happened. Essentially, as the lander was coming down, it passed through the rim of the crater that it was expected to land in, and the computers on board thought, okay, that's it, I'm done, I've reached the surface of the moon. And so it shut off its landing engines and then it accelerated towards the surface because it still had about another 5 kilometers to fall before it hit the bottom of the crater. Now, this destroyed the spacecraft and all of the experiments and so on board. But one of the team that worked on a little rover that was attached to the Hakuto R have produced a paper, even though their mission and their experiment was entirely destroyed. And so they were sort of what it was like and how things went on the way to the moon, and then they had to say goodbye. And the idea was really clever. So it's the 10 kilogram Rashid 1 rover, and it was built by the UAE. It had a bunch of experiments on board, but there was a couple of passive experiments on as well that didn't require any electricity. And one of these was that it had a bunch of examples of beeswax in little capsules on the side of the rover. And the different mixes of the beeswax would then melt at different temperatures. So one of these waxes would melt at 9 degrees Celsius, and then they had a sort of temperature range all the way to 87 Celsius. And so this would allow them to then detect temperature changes and maximums and minimums as the rover was crawling around the surface of the moon. And it was supposed to be there during a lunar eclipse. And so hopefully it would have been able to capture very rapid temperature changes. But like I said, this mission failed. And so this was them providing kind of a post-mortem, literally, of what happened to their mission. But this is great because it's sort of showing and they're talking about their results and what's going to happen next time. And hopefully we will see this experiment fly to the moon in the future. We've got a story about this from Andy Tomaswick. Now, normally James Webb is used to look outside the solar system, but it can look at objects here inside the solar system. And one of the most interesting targets has been Jupiter's moon Io, the most volcanically active place in the solar system. And so in 2022 and in 2023, astronomers pointed James Webb at Io and looked for changes on the surface of this moon. And changes they found. And so one of the largest changes that it found was its big lava lake, Loci Patera. And they found that it actually developed a new crust across its surface. And then another volcanic region on Io had expanded about four times its size. One of the really interesting things that James Webb did was help resolve a mystery about Io. And so when there is spectroscopy done on Io, people have detected the presence of different versions of sulfur. You have neutral sulfur atoms that are on the surface of Io, and then you also see sulfur oxide. And astronomers knew that there was some kind of interaction with Jupiter's magnetosphere that would strip away the sulfur from the sulfur oxide and turn it into neutral sulfur. And they were able to actually then measure the interactions between the magnetosphere around Jupiter with the sulfur on the surface of Io to be able to learn the process of how you get this neutral sulfur on the surface of Io. And it appears to be driven through its interactions with the magnetosphere. While the sulfur oxide, these are belched out of the volcanoes on Io. Now let's look at a picture of a space bat. So every year, the space agencies, when they're not shut down, are releasing images that are kind of related to upcoming holidays or various special events. So we see Valentine's-related craters on Mars and things like that. And we see a lot of stuff related to Halloween. And so the European Southern Observatory released this image of a star-forming region that's seen from the Southern Hemisphere. It's two separate clouds, RCW 94 and 95, and together they're about four times the size of the moon. And this is a star-forming region, the kind of thing that you get with, say, the Orion Nebula or the Tarantula Nebula, but it looks like a bat. And so they released this image just before Halloween. And so now you've got a bat, a space bat. And so the glow that you're seeing here, this is captured by the visible and infrared instrument attached to the Paranal Observatory. And you can see these darker filaments that are all through the clouds of gas and dust. And so inside those little dark tendrils are where the new stars are forming. This is the kind of object that you would then look at with James Webb to be able to see those new stars forming inside the clouds of gas and dust. But it's a very cool picture. All right, we've got a story from Matt Williams that goes into more. And here is your bonus story. Now, von Neumann probes. This is the idea that the most efficient way to explore the galaxy is to send self-replicating robot probes. You send a spacecraft to a system, it searches for sources of rocks and metal and then builds copies of itself, and then those go out to other star systems. And depending on sort of how advanced your technology is, you could fully explore an entire galaxy. Say you could, you know, you could build a database of 100 billion stars in about 1 million years. That, you know, even just going 10% the speed of light, you could just make your way to every single star in your entire galaxy. And, you know, this is the thing that we're thinking of. And so it seems likely that other civilizations have thought of the same thing. Why wouldn't they send spacecraft to the solar system and then start producing more copies of themselves? And if there's tons of civilizations out there, then you would expect that many have set up shop here in the solar system. We just need to find them. So there's a new paper by Alex Ellery, and I've interviewed Alex in the past. He's got a lot of great ideas about in situ resource utilization. He's done calculations about how to stop von Neumann probes from going crazy over millions of years. And he talks about the kind of, what would be the priorities of a von Neumann probe as it comes into the solar system. So he suggests you expect kind of it to take six steps. So at first it would be targeting asteroids and moons, looking for raw materials. Then it would build a bunch of surveying probes that would go out throughout the entire solar system to really better understand it. Then it would select and secure resource-rich locations like the asteroid belt or moons with a lot of resources on board. Then it would start to replicate itself to build more copies and start sending those out to other star systems. And then it would do a deeper exploration of the solar system. And eventually it would serve some kind of purpose. So like maybe you want to build a giant laser that can be used to accelerate or decelerate spacecraft from other star systems. Or maybe you want to build O'Neill cylinders. And so you would expect it to move through all of these stages of its process. And so this gives us a bunch of clues and hints for what we could search for here in the solar system. You know, it's always funny when people accuse me of like not being open-minded to alien probes coming into the solar system. We report on this stuff all the time on Universe Today. Now, this is a lot of space news, but this is just a fraction of the news that we're covering over on Universe Today. So every week we do, you know, like 30 to 40 space news stories. And so, you know, we only grab just a small handful for this week's Space Bites. But if you want a more comprehensive view of all of the space stories, you should definitely check out Universe Today. For example, astronomers spot a white dwarf that's still consuming its planets. A red dwarf star has been found with a brown dwarf companion. And when neutron stars collide, how their neutrinos can influence their collision. And just to make this very easy for you, I write a weekly email newsletter that has an overview of every single one of the stories that we cover on Universe Today with a nice picture. And I write every word myself. It's completely free. There's no ads. You can unsubscribe anytime. So if you want that, go to universetoday.com/newsletter to sign up. Okay, well, that was all the space news that we have this week. Now I'm going to talk about sort of the state of NASA's websites and how we're doing our reporting in this government shutdown. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Barely Griffin, Brian Bodie, Caradwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Bielak, Cy Nielsen, Dark Finga, Dave Verybaugh, David Gilton, and David Matz, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, James Clark, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Smits, Michael Purcell, OneStepForAnimals.org, Paul Robach, Brent Kaidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Fowler-Munley, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, Vlad Shiplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So I went to the NASA JPL website today just to look up some recent news and some data information. And there's a banner across the top that says this website is not being updated because of the government shutdown. And none of the NASA websites are being updated. None of the social media feeds are being updated. Astronomy picture of the day is not being updated, which is heartbreaking. And this is the state. And so, you know, as a space journalist, it is like one of my main sources of information has been cut off, snuffed out. It's definitely made my job a lot more difficult now to be able to respond to this. But, you know, I have a lot of sources that I deal with. And actually, this is a great example of an episode. I think there's three or four stories in this episode that relate to work from the Chinese Space Agency, and then a story from the United Arab Emirates, and then a story from the European Southern Observatory. So without all of the news coming from NASA, this allows a lot of the more international news to shine. But the people who are working on the research that turns into NASA research are still hard at work. There's just other ways that this information flows around. And of course, I like to go right back to the source. I go to Archive, which is the preprint location where a lot of researchers post their latest research. I look at the various journals where people are still publishing things. And in many cases, they submitted their work to the journal months ago, and it's just finally making its way out to the journal. And there are still raw feeds. Last week, we were able to get images of Comet 3I Atlas because of the punch mission. And it's run by the Southwest Research Institute. They're not able to report on what they're doing, but the data feeds are all available. And so you can just kind of go through them and grab what you need. So it's definitely been a difficult time. And like on the one hand, it really sucks that NASA is not able to make all of the amazing work that they normally do, you know, available to the internet. And I guess at the same time, this is given a chance for other voices to be heard, that there's a lot of really interesting research and work that's being done by many different nations around the world and not just the United States. And so, you know, this is my chance to kind of force myself to dig deeper and look for other interesting sources. And so hopefully it hasn't felt as a viewer that the volume of the news or the interestingness of the news that we're reporting has gotten any worse. But still, I would love this shutdown to be over so that we can get back to talking with NASA researchers and including their information into the mix. All right, we will see you next time.